Who is an old stranger, David Orchard, honorary chair of the Citizens Concerned About Free Trade. Way yes. Those of you in the audience who need interpretation when questions are asked in French, there are earphones available, so you might want to avail yourself of the yourselves of the earphones when it comes up. Welcome, Mr. Orchard, and you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the invitation to appear before your committee. Je vais parler en anglais pour mon discours, mais si vous avez des questions en français, je serai heureux de répondre en français, monsieur. Et bienvenue en Saskatchewan, et bienvenue à Saskatoon même. What I'll do in my presentation, I think you've prepared a background document called Canada and the Future of the North American Relationship, an outline of key issues and questions for public discussion, which I understand you want public response to. So I'll begin by looking at that document and then wind up with a few remarks, and I'm happy to take any questions or interactions that that you might have. I could say right off the bat that I was stunned by the tone of the document that you've prepared, that the staff has prepared for this committee. The entire focus on this document is on deeper integration, is the term, deeper integration with the United States. Right off the bat, the document informs us that Canada is and will remain much more, that the U.S. is and will remain much more important to Canada than Canada is to it. And that Canada is less important to the United States than it has been decades earlier, one reason being a general decrease in Canada's global economic, diplomatic, and military power. But then in the question section, rather than seek ideas about how to reverse this trend and increase Canada's economic and global power, you're simply asking us if we should, it would be useful to increase the numbers of diplomatic personnel stationed in the United States. The next section of the document informs us that Canada's high economic vulnerability to border disruption is a given, which must be taken into account in deciding the best policy response. Again, in the questions posed, there's not a single question on whether Canada should or whether Canada can reduce this high economic vulnerability. The section on the Canada-United States economic relationship says that given the size of the United States, it may be preferable that the determination of the nature, speed, and extent of further economic integration be done proactively. So in other words, we've got the government of Canada putting out this document that says, given that it seems we're being assimilated into the United States, maybe we should apply to be assimilated even quicker. The
correct to say that it's the government of Canada. This is a background document prepared by the Library of Parliament.
The research department, well, I understand the research department for the department. It's a research section, is it not? It says the Parliamentary Research Branch for the External Affairs and International Trade.
Still prepared by the Library of Parliament.
For the committee.
Then I'm,
for the committee.
But it's a document that your committee is putting out.
Yes, but
right?
we're not speaking for the government of Canada. We're a parliamentary committee.
Good. Then I'm reacting to the document that's been put out and that's been asked for public discussion, so I hope you'll take this message back to Ottawa that the public doesn't like it, at least the public that I represent.
Go ahead.
We're asked if Canada should move directly to focus on a strengthened and deepened North American community and whether we should, what options should be pursued, a customs union, a common market, or an economic union. But there's no question about whether we should pursue greater independence for our country. It's simply not there. It's not even hinted at. The document says, of the four possible alternatives for the Canada-U.S. relationship, one, making improvements to the existing framework, second, a customs union, third, a common market, or fourth, an economic union, which integration option do you prefer? There is not even a question for the majority of Canadians who don't want their country to be integrated into the United States. It simply doesn't appear. Having waded through this document, one has the sense it could well have come out of the U.S. State Department. The entire focus is on deeper integration into the United States. And if we accept that the primary role of government is to guard a nation's sovereignty, to promote the well-being of its citizens, how do we justify a document that promotes, examines the integration of Canada into the United States? And my question is, why is there not a chapter on how to deal with our sovereignty, how to safeguard our sovereignty, and how to reduce our weaknesses? There are numerous examples of countries around the world that have done exactly that and traded very profitably. I could mention Norway, I could mention Switzerland, both of which stayed out of the European Union but have done very well. Thank you. And as for the document's praise of the so-called free trade agreements, this is a theme that runs through the document. The free trade deal and NAFTA did not deliver free trade at all. In fact, what they do is increase American protectionism against Canada's exports. Our trade with the United States today is less free than it was before we signed these agreements. Prior to the free trade agreement, our average tariff on our exports to the United States was less than 1%. And we had very good protection against American countervail and anti-dumping duties. What's happened since? Let's look at lumber. Ever since the founding of GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, in 1947, the Americans have, up till the time of the free trade deal, never once imposed a countervailing duty on our lumber. We had, in essence, free trade in lumber. In 82, 83, when the American lumber companies applied for a countervailing duty, the U.S. Commerce Department turned them down because they knew very well that the Trudeau government would invoke our GATT rights and fight it. Furthermore, we had a Federal Employment Support Act introduced in 1971, which was brought in expressly to defend Canadian companies and Canadian interests in the case of harassment of our exports by foreign companies. So this was the situation before the free trade agreement. The Americans not once took action against our lumber or our Canadian wheat board or key industries. What's happened since the FTA and NAFTA? We now have 27% duties on our lumber. We've had 10 investigations of the Canadian Wheat Board in as many years. And now we have massive new American subsidies directed against our farm producers in this country. And the Employment Support Act, which authorized the federal government to provide assistance to mitigate the disruptive effects of foreign duties, is of course nullified by the FTA. And so we have the federal government today simply standing by and watching as whole industries and employment of Canadians goes down the tubes. So this fundamental fact bears repeating. The FTA and NAFTA did not reduce American protectionism. These agreements freed up American protectionism and gave it a much stronger hand against Canada, while at the same time massively restricting Canada's sovereignty and our ability to react in our own self-interest. The FTA and NAFTA exposed Canadian companies completely by writing into those documents all U.S. trade law, present and future. And they replaced the GATT dispute settlement panel with a kangaroo court, the North American NAFTA panel, which costs Canadian companies a small fortune to appear in front of. And if they have a small chance of winning, but if they do win, the Americans are completely free to rewrite their trade law exactly as they did under lumber. So, all with the blessing of the FTA and NAFTA. So these are the agreements that this document is praising as the cornerstone of Canada-U.S. economic relations. So just in winding up, I would like to pose a few questions of my own for consideration by the government, members of the panel, and then for the opposition members. Our tax dollars have been spent to write a paper which essentially promotes one option, namely the dismantling of our country and its integration into the United States. And I want to know how the federal government and this committee justify that. And I'd like to ask the government members, why did former Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau call the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement a monstrous swindle? Why did former Prime Minister John Turner call the Free Trade Agreement the Sale of Canada Act, the most devastating piece of legislation ever brought before the House of Commons, a bill that will end Canada as we know it and replace it with a Canada that will become nothing more than a colony of the United States? And why did the current Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien, write in his autobiography that those who argue that free trade is our only hope and perhaps inevitable have either given up on the idea of a unique and independent Canada or haven't thought about the consequences? So my question is, has the Liberal Party given up on the idea of a sovereign and independent Canada, or does it regard its past leaders as having been in a fog about the consequences of free trade? And of course, the last question to the Liberals is, why did the Liberal Party campaign so vigorously against free trade when it came to power in 93, promising to renegotiate or abrogate these agreements in their red book? But the Alliance Party, your push is essentially the same thing. Rather than provide an opportunity to defend Canada's sovereignty. You're encouraging the Liberals to go faster down the road to integration. Your new leader talks fondly about the idea of adopting the U.S. dollar as the common currency for North America. So there's no defense of our nation there. Common currency with the United States, of course, is the end of any kind of fiscal or economic independence. Et pour le Bloc québécois, vous êtes pour l'assimilation de Canada dans les États-Unis, Monsieur Duceppe, il est pour un dollar commun, un dollar américain pour Canada et pour le Québec aussi. Si la raison d'être de la Parti québécoise est pour défendre la langue et la culture américaine, la culture québécoise, comment on peut dire nous sommes pour le dollar américain comme devise pour Amérique du Nord? C'est impossible d'avoir la souveraineté, c'est impossible de garder la langue et la culture française avec le dollar américain comme devise. If I can say in English, if the goal, the raison d'être of the Bloc québécois is to protect the language and the French culture in Canada, how is this going to be possible once Canada is assimilated into the United States? The leader of the Bloc Québécois is openly calling for a common currency in North America. I wonder if he believes that the Americans are going to amend their constitution to provide charter guarantees for the French language in North America. It will not happen. And I believe that all of these parties have essentially betrayed those Canadians who want our country to survive as an independent country on the face of this planet. That's what I stand for, and these documents and the thrust that I've seen coming out of our government is a betrayal of that. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Well, one of the intentions of the background papers, Mr. Orchard, was to provoke thought, and you've certainly responded in kind. So we thank you for that. And we'll begin with Dr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Harvard, and thank you, Mr. Orchard, for being here today. For the record, this document's not put forth by the government. It's not put forth by this committee. It's put forth by the Library of Parliament simply to ask questions. It has absolutely no bearing on government policy or, indeed, on the policies of any member at this committee. They're questions put forth by researchers. Interdependence, while being independence, I think, is the objective that we have. And the question that I would ask you, given that our country relies on trade in order to maintain our standard of living, what would you do to change the NAFTA to ensure that we have, would you scrap it altogether? Would you erect barriers to trade? Would you make this a fortress Canada?
Well, I'll start with your first comment about this document. State that it's not something that binds your committee or even represents your committee. The disturbing fact is that this document represents both government policy and in a disturbing way reflects the Alliance Party policy too, one of deepening integration of our country into the United States. So it's not by accident this is the document that's put out on your website. And the point that I'm making is...
On our website, the website of the committee. It has absolutely nothing to do with the Canadian Alliance whatsoever.
I'm talking about the website of the committee, not your Alliance website.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Thank you
for making that distinction.
Okay. But the connection with the Alliance is that the Alliance is going across this country promoting more Americanization of our country and toying with the idea of a monetary union. So this is the question. Wendy Dobson came out recently talking about a new architecture for North America. We've got Thomas Corshane promoting the idea of a monetary union. These ideas are coming at us from many, many different directions, and we see no defense of Canada as a sovereign nation in terms of increasing our sovereignty, and we haven't seen that defense from the Alliance. The question that you ask about what I would do with these agreements, I'm not against trade. I'm not about to build a fortress around North America. I'm a farmer. I farm here in Western Canada in Saskatchewan with the most trade-dependent province in the country. I'm not against trade, and maybe not even free trade if such a thing existed, but these documents, as I pointed out, restrict our access to the U.S. economy. Our trade with the United States is less free today than before we had these agreements because we've given up the rights that we had to defend ourselves before. Your party is calling in the House for support for the lumber producers and their employees out in British Columbia. How long do you think that would withstand a NAFTA challenge? the government is standing up and responding to you in the House saying we can't do that under our international trade agreements. I happen to think that the government is correct. We've bound ourselves into agreements that tie our hands in terms of exercising our own self-interest. Now, when you ask what I would do about that, the Liberals had the answer very clearly. They said we would renegotiate or abrogate. This is the position that Mr. Chrétien campaigned across the country on. The Red Book contained four major areas that the Liberals promised to renegotiate. They didn't renegotiate any of them, but they understood the problems. You can't tie yourself into an agreement with the United States, 10 times larger than us, that gives up our rights to defend our industries, which is what we've done.
Mr. Orchard, don't you think that all the objective evidence actually would fly completely in the face of what you're saying, and I think you've heard that before. Our objective is interdependence with the U.S., with independence for Canada. What we're trying to do is defend the sovereignty of our country, defend the rights of Canadians to work, defend the rights of Canadians to have a better life, better jobs, better employment, put food on the table, which you do as a for a living, better education, better health care, all of those things which we are all trying very hard to do. Now, before NAFTA, as you know, there was no adequate dispute resolution mechanism with the U.S. You're aware that in more than two-thirds of the cases where we've had difficulties with the United States on trade within NAFTA, Canada has won. That never happened before NAFTA. And on the issue of the softwood lumber, the problem with softwood lumber, as you know, is that softwood lumber, unfortunately, is not it's not under the NAFTA. If it was under the NAFTA, the Americans wouldn't be able to attempt to bully us in the manner that they have. So my question is, how would you change the dispute resolution mechanism that we have? Because, you know, I think that that has to change, but how would you do that? And how would you compare the dispute resolution mechanisms post-NAFTA to pre-NAFTA?
Now, when you suggest that the evidence flies in the face of what I'm saying, I would suggest it's indisputable that we're much worse off today. You come from British Columbia. We had free trade in lumber before the free trade agreement negotiations started. What is the situation today? How many thousand jobs? I use the quote of your party in the House talking about over 20,000 jobs lost. That's what's happened under NAFTA, our largest export in wheat, in barley, in cereal grains. If you take a look at this U.S. Farm Bill, we're much worse off, and we have no retaliatory rights. And if you'll just let me finish this, across the country, we're seeing American companies buying up what's left of the Canadian economy. In British Columbia, Weyerhaeuser coming in and taking over McMillan Bloedel. On the prairies here, ADM coming in and buying up United Grain Growers, and now AgriCorp control there. All across the country, what the Americans are simply buying at a 63-cent dollar, what's left of Canadian industry. So to say that that's a good thing, I differ with you entirely. You said before NAFTA, under the dispute settlement system at GATT, we lost more often. That's simply not true. In my book, I trace each one of those disputes, the nine disputes that we had with the United States in the three decades before the free trade agreement. We won every one of them. So your facts are simply wrong. Under NAFTA, now, the problem with the dispute settlement mechanism is under GATT, a third country, a neutral country, adjudicated a dispute between Canada and the United States. It would be Norway or it would be some other country that would sit and adjudicate it. That was a much fairer system, and the legal fees for our producers were handled by the government of Canada. So it didn't cost our industries millions of dollars to defend themselves. Under NAFTA, it's just the opposite. We're in a panel, one-on-one with just the Americans, and our industries have to pay lawyers to appear in front of those tribunals in Washington at extremely onerous costs. We've got smaller industries in Canada that give up simply because they can't cover the legal fees. We had the hog industry targeted here in the prairies. We've had a whole number of others. I talked to Mr. Zimmerman, the former head of Noranda, about the huge legal fees that the lumber industry in this country is paying to defend itself in front of these hearings. Under the GATT, those fees were covered by the Canadian government, so our industries were much more protected. And further than that, as I mentioned, we had this legislation in place that we could defend our industries while they were being targeted. If you attempted to do that now, you would run up instantly against a NAFTA lawsuit.
Well, softwood, as you know, is not into the NAFTA.
It is. It's incorporated right in. The softwood lumber memorandum is incorporated into the text of the free trade agreement.
It's a separate agreement. That's why we're 5 years after we negotiated.
Yes, and that's NAFTA. And that is incorporated into the text of the free trade agreement. If you'll study your text of the NAFTA, that softwood lumber memorandum is incorporated into the text.
Anyway.
Thank you. We'll now go to Mr. Rostov.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. Bonjour, Monsieur Orchard. Merci pour vos bons mots en français. Je constate que vous avez beaucoup d'attachement pour le concept, pour la notion de souveraineté.
Oui.
Vous êtes jaloux de la souveraineté canadienne, sachant sans doute que le Canada constitue une société distincte par rapport aux États-Unis.
Oui.
Vous avez compris que c'est aussi notre prétention, que nous sommes une société distincte par rapport au Canada. C'est pourquoi des gens comme moi, des millions... Des centaines de milliers de Québécois préconisent la souveraineté du Québec pour mieux affirmer sa distinction dans le calme, dans la sérénité, dans l'harmonie avec son bon voisin que le Canada. Donc, on compatit ensemble quant à l'attachement qu'on a envers le concept de la souveraineté. Quant à l'utilisation du dollar canadien, préconisé, comme vous le dites, par M. Duceppe, c'est une hypothèse qui circule, c'est sûr, qui mérite d'être envisagée, mais ce que M. Duceppe préconise surtout, c'est la mise sur pied d'un institut monétaire qui regrouperait des Américains, des Canadiens et des Mexicains pour qu'on analyse ensemble quelle est la meilleure voie à suivre pour donner un exemple facile, pour peut-être pas commettre l'erreur que l'Argentine a commise en allant trop vite peut-être dans un nouvel réaménagement de sa monnaie, ce qui a donné des résultats peut-être bénéfiques temporairement, mais à moyen et long terme, on voit les inconvénients majeurs que ça cause encore récemment. Donc, c'était pour établir deux faits. Quant à l'intégration aux États-Unis, je me demande si... moi, je ne suis pas un expert dans la matière, je suis un citoyen comme les autres, on a peut-être un peu plus d'informations que la moyenne, mais je me demande s'il n'y a pas là simplement une réaction de défense, d'autodéfense de la part du Canada face à l'attitude américaine qui est carrément hégémonique. Hein, c'est une attitude hégémonique de la part des États-Unis. Et je pense que c'est une question d'ajustement, c'est une question d'adaptation à une situation qui est fatale. On a le plus puissant pays du monde, peut-être le plus puissant dans l'histoire du monde, et là, notre voisin, et n'a pas comme attitude, comme culture, de respecter ce qui est autour, c'est plutôt... Hein, l'exemple qui me vient à l'esprit, c'est la mise en place d'un système de missiles antimissiles où le Canada va être invité à participer. Si le Canada dit non, j'aimerais avoir votre opinion, est-ce que le Canada peut se permettre de dire non, une fois que le mouvement est parti? Parce que si on n'est pas partie prenante à la démarche, il y aura sans doute un prix à payer, ne serait-ce qu'en termes de dommages collatéraux. Hein, s'il y avait des erreurs de commise, à quelle place que les bombes vont tomber, ils peuvent très bien tomber en Saskatchewan, comme au Québec, comme en Ontario, et alors qu'on pourrait peut-être procéder autrement si on fait partie de la démarche. C'est un exemple que je donne. Et moi, là où ça me fait peur davantage, c'est quand on parle de mondialisation, d'ailleurs, et d'intégration avec les États-Unis, c'est toute la question du rôle de l'État. Le rôle de l'État sur le plan social, notamment, et sur le plan culturel. Où, sur le plan social, le Canada et le Québec se sont donné des programmes sociaux qui en font une société très civilisée, beaucoup plus sophistiquée que la société américaine, notamment. Et les Américains, au train où vont les choses, pourront se permettre de remettre ça en question, ce modèle-là, cette façon de faire-là, au même titre que la culture. Et là, le Québec se distingue carrément de par sa langue, parce qu'on sait que les Canadiens anglais sont très influencés par la culture américaine, écoutent des postes de télévision américaine beaucoup plus que le Québec, et c'est l'inverse d'ailleurs. Radio-Canada, français au Québec, est très, très, très écouté, fait partie de la production culturelle du Québec, alors qu'à ce que je sache, statistiquement, CBC est plus ou moins écouté et arrive au même niveau que d'autres postes américains, si ce n'est pas au troisième ou quatrième rang, bien souvent, à ce que je sache. Donc, j'aimerais vous entendre commenter là-dessus, un sur les missiles, l'antimissile, et sur le sens qu'aurait peut-être l'intégration aux États-Unis sur le plan du rôle de l'État.
Comme vous avez dit, c'est vrai, les Québécois ont eu une longue lutte de protéger leur langue et leur culture en Amérique du Nord. quel est le moyen le plus efficace de faire ça?
D'après moi, c'est dans l'État canadien, c'est dans la Fédération canadienne. Le résultat ici, vous avez la langue qui vit encore. Nous avons une culture qui existe encore en français. Mais si on adopte le dollar américain, si on devenir plus assimilé par les États-Unis, d'après moi, ça c'est la fin de la langue culture, de la langue française et la fée française en Amérique du Nord. Parce que c'est pas possible de garder la langue française dedans les États-Unis. Et ça c'est le danger. Ça c'est le danger de la position de M. Duceppe, d'après moi. Si on a une union monétaire avec Mexique et avec les États-Unis, avec Canada, c'est les États-Unis qui est le partenaire le plus grand, le plus fort. Et peut-être on peut garder la langue espagnole, à cause du fait qu'il y a beaucoup de personnes qui parlent espagnol aux États-Unis et en Mexique, mais pour la langue française, ça c'est une chose différente. Et pour moi, le moyen le plus efficace, c'est de garder la souveraineté du Canada avec un Québec très fort dans cet État. Ça, c'est dans les années passées, c'est une alliance entre les autochtones et les francophones et les anglophones qui a résisté les invasions par les États-Unis à Québec. On a eu les trois invasions par les Américains. C'est les Québécois qui a résisté ça. Et c'est pas le moment de dire « Ah, c'est tout est fini maintenant, d'après moi. » Mais votre question concernant le rôle de l'État, dedans une union monétaire avec les États-Unis, c'est très difficile de protéger les programmes sociaux, le rôle de l'État québécois, bien sûr, parce que...
Du Canada.
Le Canada aussi, exactement. Exactement la même chose. Oui,
on peut diverger d'opinion, mais quant au... Quant au Canada, c'est notre... Oui. faut que je te rappellerai. Salut, Marie. Salut.
Is Mr. Russell?
Yes. Okay. I know.
it's the 21st century. That's all I can say.
I shut mine off.
Il est deux.
Peut-être c'est le premier de la province du Québec.
I would like to ask one or two questions, Mr. Orchard. In the closing part of your written text, you pose a series of questions, which I would respectfully submit are not a part of this committee's mandate, and to that extent, I think they're red herrings. Let's talk about North American integration and the state of North American integration. I think you have indicated very strongly that you don't like the current state of affairs, and you've also delineated some of the things that you don't want to see done further to that integration. You don't want a customs union, you don't want a common market, you don't want dollarization. What you don't tell us, though, is what you would do given the current state of affairs. You know, the past is the past. We can perhaps undo it, but there is no changing history that we do have the FTA. We do have NAFTA. So I guess my first question would be, what are some of your remedies? For example, would you withdraw from NAFTA? Would you withdraw from FTA?
Good questions. And I'll turn it back to you. Your party...
No, I'm not here to answer the questions. I want you to answer the questions.
I'm answering your question, Mr. Harvard. Your party answered these questions very well for us when you said you would renegotiate or abrogate. And Mr. Kretchen said, if we can't renegotiate, you know we'll abrogate.
Why don't we keep personalities out of it? Because I can play that game as well, Mr. Orchard. I know Mr. Mulroney. I know that you were a conservative candidate. I know what Mr. Mulroney said about free trade in 1983, and I know what he said in 1988. And there was about a 180-degree move. So let's not get into that, okay? I would be more interested in what your remedies are without rehashing the past and trying to personalize the issues.
Now, I was attempting to answer your question, Mr. Harvard. I said that I agreed with Mr. Kretchen's solution. I think that we should renegotiate, or if not...
How?
If, just a minute, I'll answer your question if you permit me. The free trade agreement and NAFTA, you say these are here with us. They both contain a clause saying that Canada can withdraw by simply giving 6 months' notice.
Yeah.
And if we did so, the sky wouldn't fall in at all. We would simply revert back to the GATT rules that have governed our trade with the United States for the last five decades. Those rules were much better to Canada than these rules are, much more favorable to our industries. So this idea, some people say, oh, we withdraw, it would be a terrible situation. It wouldn't be a terrible situation at all. Both Canada and the United States are members of the WTO GATT. We would both be bound by those rules. If we withdrew, we would simply go back to those rules and be much better off. Now,
Mr. Orchard,
it's as easy as that, 6 months' notice.
Because you could, you know, one might say that the egg has been scrambled with respect to FTA and NAFTA,
yeah,
and that it's pretty hard to put that old egg back together again.
Yeah. One could say that, but one could also note that it would be quite simple. We our tariffs were diminishing anyway, and we don't have to go back to tariffs, but we have to go back to putting the power back in the hands of the state. As Mr. Rushville mentioned, the power of the state is very important for a smaller country like Canada. Under NAFTA, we gave American corporations, private corporations, the right to sue Canada directly for any law or regulation they don't like in this country. So we're overturning our environmental laws and other things to please American private industry. We need to get that power back. And when you ask what my solution is, I visited Norway not long ago. Norway is a small country next door to the European Union. Powerful bloc. They've had two referendums on whether or not they would join the European Union. Norwegians were told, if we don't join, we're going to be left out in the cold. It'll be a terrible thing for us. Norwegians voted against it, and where is Norway today? No debt, no deficit, no downsizing, richest social programs in the world. They trade very profitably with the European Union, but they guard the right to protect their farmers, their industry. They don't allow more than 15% of their oil patches, I understand it, to be foreign-owned. They use that revenue to defend their social programs. Switzerland, little country in, right in the middle of the European Union, but it's kept its own independence and it's stayed out of the European Union. No one's telling the Swiss you have to give up your franc and adopt a common currency. So these are countries that have done very well. Canada could do the same thing, perch next door to the United States. We should be selling all kinds of things to the United States. We shouldn't be giving these things away. Our oil and gas, for example, going straight south across the border, all that petroleum coming out of the tar sands at a 0% royalty. What are we getting out of this? We're getting out of Alberta's getting a royalty of a quarter of what the Norwegians are getting out of their oil and gas because we've locked ourselves into this agreement that allows the Americans to simply come and buy up our industry. Same in terms of agriculture. The people who were in front of you previously talked about where the profits from agriculture are going. So we need to put those industries back in Canadian hands, and it's not a red herring if you'll be so kind as to allow me to respond. It's not a red herring to quote Prime Minister Trudeau on this issue because he had thought about it for a long time, and when he called it a monstrous swindle, I think he had studied it very, very carefully because we had, before these agreements, we had the right in Canadian hands to defend our industries, and that's the step that we have to go back to.
Let me ask you one question having to do with your suggestion that perhaps we abrogate NAFTA or the FTA and at least go back. This would be one step, I guess, go back to where we were prior to 1988. If we were to go back to 1988, we would then be re-erecting the tariff walls that then existed. Under FTA, as you know, those tariff walls have gone. And that has changed the business relationship, I would say, you know, quite dramatically. Right now, I think we've gone too far in our dependence on trade with the Americans, but it now sits at about, you know, 87% of our entire trade. So, and it may have to do with this analogy of the, you know, the scrambled egg and how you put it together. How, from just a practical point of view, Mr. Orchard, do you re-erect those tariff walls?
First of all, we wouldn't have to re-erect those tariff walls at all. As I pointed out to you, 80% of our trade had no tariff on it at all before the free trade agreement, and our average tariff was less than 1%. So tariffs really aren't a factor, and when you study the document, as I'm sure you have, 20 chapters in it, only one deals with tariffs. Tariffs are not a major factor at all. If we stepped out, we could leave the tariffs at zero, as Mr. Trudeau pointed out. They were headed that way under the GATT anyway. So that's not the major...
Jen, what about the question of national treatment,
mm-hmm,
where we really subordinate the politics to the discipline of business or the marketplace.
Yeah.
Well, how would you deal with that?
I would step back from that. Preferably, I would want to see us go back to the GATT WTO rules that gave us much more latitude to protect our fishery or our timber or our farmers. But what I'm calling for, and you mentioned the Conservative Party, one of the reasons I stepped into politics was to correct what I saw as the errors Mr. Mulroney made. So that's why I'm here and I put my ideas forward. But I'm calling for a blue ribbon commission to look at the impact of the free trade agreement. And this is what an idea I'd like to put forward to your committee as well. Rather than jumping us right down the road to further integration, deeper integration, inevitable common linkage, all this, we've had over 10 years. Let's do a commission across the country looking at the impact of free trade and NAFTA. Has it been good for us, as Mr. Martin maintains, or has it been, as Orchard maintains? Let's have someone, you can take Peter Lougheed, you can take prominent civil servants, Mel Clark, who was one of our negotiators, put these people in charge of that panel and take public testimony across the country. We've had this experience with NAFTA and the FTA. Is it working for Canada? Are there places that it should be changed? Should it be gotten rid of? These are the questions that I think we should look at as a nation, instead of simply adopting a kind of a religious ideology that disagreements are good and therefore we're going to go into deeper integration. I think it's a fatal error, and I don't think we're going to be able to survive as a country if we integrate ourselves any further.
That's fair. I think Mr. Martin has a question before we wrap up.
Just a couple, Mr. Orchard. And just for the record, according to our information, our trade with the United States and trade with all NAFTA countries has increased about 100% with the Mexicans and over 12% with the U.S. And that's, as you appreciate, something over, that's over $70 billion. So that's a lot of jobs. Now, you're a farmer, and you brought up a couple of interesting questions. You said that industries are bought up by companies in the U.S., and in many cases you're quite right, which is disturbing, obviously, for all of us. But I would ask you, how would you prevent people and private companies in the U.S. from buying up Canadian companies, since they're two independent private entities? Mm-hmm. For example, you're a farmer. If you wanted to sell your farm to somebody from the U.S., should one be prevented from doing that? And the second question that I have, it's really along the lines of the same one, is that you want to put Canadian industries in Canada back into Canadian hands. How would you do that? And then lastly, perhaps we haven't derived as much benefit as we could have from the free trade agreement because of our low dollar, which I would suggest to you is due to a lack of competitiveness and productivity related to our high taxes and rules and regulations. How would you improve our competitiveness?
I'll start with your question number one first about sale of our industries if I wanted to sell my farm. Actually, here in Saskatchewan, we have a Farmland Ownership Act that prohibits a foreigner from buying farms in Saskatchewan. So I cannot, under the legislation that exists today, sell my farm to an American. And as a result, we have much lower farmland prices in Saskatchewan than anywhere else in the prairies. And that is actually an added incentive for people from other parts of the country to come and start farming here, or for young farmers to get going here. So I think I would argue that that law has served our farmers well. And there's a major debate in this province about exactly whether that act should be changed.
So you have a law that prevented a Canadian company, from basically selling itself to an American interest.
Well, many countries have these. In fact, most countries have, and we once had the Foreign Investment Review Agency that reviewed takeovers of Canadian industries to ascertain whether they're in Canada's interests, and if they weren't, that body had the power to turn them down. And no less a figure than Peter Lougheed has recently come out and said perhaps we have to relook at having another FIRA in Canada, because he said we're going to turn around 2 or 3 years from now and ask what have we got left. Now, this is Mr. Lougheed, who was once promoting the free trade agreement. So this is the conclusion that he's come to. But when you talk about our trade having increased 12% with the United States, I would argue that that's largely not because of NAFTA or the FTA, but because of the low dollar, and because the American economy has been in a robust position most of that time. So I would argue that it's in fact got nothing to do with NAFTA. And I was interested that your background document made precisely the same point, that that argument could be plausibly made, and I've been making it for a long time, that it's the low dollar that's encouraging sales of our exports to the United States much more than NAFTA.
It also says that it's increased by up at 12%. it's really 9% is due to the NAFTA. So
no, well, the
bottom of the page, you have the same document I have.
Yeah, now this is the breakdown that they're attempting to make, but they're saying the argument can plausibly be made that that other factors had as much, if not more, to do with the terminology they use than NAFTA. But you ask, what can we do? I think we should have a Canadian automobile industry. We should have a Canadian shipping industry. We're the nation with the longest coastline in the world, and we apparently can't even build ships anymore. I'm a farmer, and in Western Canada here, I cannot even buy a major piece of farm equipment that's made by a Canadian company in Canada anymore.
Massey, well, I'm interested because it's important for my... It's a very good example that you use because it's from the West Coast of shipbuilding. And we've asked that question, too. The problem is, as you know, is that in Canada, in manufacturing ships... The problem is we have a difficulty competing with, say, the Chinese that are making ships because their employment cost is so much lower than ours that for us to build a boat, the cost of a Canadian boat would be so much more than the cost of a Chinese boat, so we can't compete in that area.
I don't accept that we can't compete in that area, and I'll tell you why. In 1952, Canada and Japan had the same size economy. We outproduced the Japanese in terms of automobiles. Where are we at today? The Japanese economy is four times larger than the Canadian economy, and they outproduce the United States in terms of automobiles. They've done that through a conscious policy in Japan of building their electronics industry, their automobile industry, all of these industries. In Japan, they have forced their banks to lend to Japanese industries. They've had a conscious industrial policy to build those industries. We could do exactly the same thing. If I can take you back to the Second World War, we came out of the Second World War with the fourth largest shipping fleet in the world, ships built right here in Canada, the world's fourth largest air force.
That was 50 years ago.
That's right.
More
and
than 50 years ago.
Yes, but some things remain the same. And we were able to build those ships in Canada, put our people to work, drive our unemployment rate down from 13% to 1% during the Second World War, and build those ships. We could do the same thing. We could build a shipping industry if we had some conscious government policy to do it. We won't have any of these industries. In fact, we can't under the NAFTA, the FTA. If we attempted to build an automotive industry or a shipping industry, we would run straight into a trade action from the Americans. Even though on the U.S. side, they have their Jones Act that protects their shipping fleet. As you know, it stipulates that goods have to be transported in the bottoms built, ships built in the United States. Whereas we've exposed ourselves completely openly. We're free traders. We'll take away all of our support for farmers. We'll take away all of our support for the lumber industry. We'll take away all of our support for the shipping industry. And we'll see what happens. Well, what happens is the Americans come in and buy it up. That's the tragedy. We need to have some kind of government policy that says there are certain industries we're going to build. We can look at what the Norwegians have done, the Swedes have done.
So the government is actually putting money into
not
paying.
It doesn't necessarily have to be the government putting money into it, but it needs a framework policy. Why don't we have a Canadian automobile? We're a huge market. We could build. We've got the fuel cell technology out in your province to build virtually a pollution-free car. That technology is going to go to one of the giants. We should use that technology here to build one of the world's most advanced automobiles. We should sell it across the country, but we would have to have a framework policy in place to do that, and we'd have to get over this stuff about protectionism being a dirty word. Every nation that's ever amounted to anything on the face of this planet has protected its industries, or else they don't amount to anything.
I hate to interrupt, but... The clock says that we must move on. Mr. Orchard, I want to thank you for your appearance. I think you would make an exciting addition to the House of Commons, and judging by your strong performance this morning, I don't think you're averse to answering the call.
Thank you.
And I'm glad to note that some people agree with me.